Despite a recent dip, gas prices in general have been climbing higher, leading to calls for increased domestic oil production. As a result, energy companies have been looking toward the Arctic. This summer, Shell Oil plans to sink exploratory wells in the waters off Alaska's North Slope, a plan that has raised concerns about the fragile environment and the impact it will have on the region's native populations. Bob Rees tells the complicated story of what's at stake when the drilling begins in his book, The Eskimo and the Oil Man, The Battle at the Top of the World for America's Future. It's published by Business Plus, and I'm very pleased it has brought Mr. Rees to our show today. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm okay. The Eskimo of your title is a man named Edward Itta. Who is he?
Edward Itta is such a fascinating man. 65-year-old Inupiat Eskimo grandfather, whale hunter, and also a politician. He was, until last year, the mayor, the most powerful rural mayor you've probably never heard of. He was the mayor of the North Slope of Alaska, which is a Wyoming-sized county that it fills all of northern Alaska, about 7,500 people, mostly Inupiat Eskimos, and it has all of the U.S. Arctic oil in it.
And he was the mayor Barrow?
Well, he lived in Barrow, but the word mayor implies to the leader of a county there, even though normally it applies to the leader of a city.
Now, what is Barrow like?
Barrow's terrific. Barrow is a town at the, if you envision the map of Alaska, the absolute very top, that tip, that's Barrow.
That part that looks like fingers coming out.
Yeah, that last, very last bit of finger. And it's all the way at the top. It lays at the junction of the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas.
Now, go ahead.
4,500 people, and mostly Inupiat Eskimos, and a fabulous mix of traditional Eskimo whale hunting, going out on the tundra, get up dog sleds, and Mexican restaurants, Chinese delivery, Cambodian taxi drivers.
Now, you mentioned whale hunting twice, so this is really important to the Inupiats. Are they at all concerned about the environmental impact of killing whales? Are they aware of how the rest of the world sees that activity?
Well, okay, two separate subjects, killing whales and oil. As far as killing whales, well, they're really aware of it because the International Whaling Commission banned them from doing it back in the 70s, which was a travesty to them. And in fact, they had enormous fights with the scientists at that time because scientists were saying that the bowhead whale population was down to 600 across the Earth. The whale hunters were saying it was much more. The North Slope brought in scientists instead of lawyers, did their own studies, learned that there were many more whales than the environmentalists said, and the law was changed.
Is there some irony in the fact that whales used to be the major source of oil?
There's great irony of it. Great, great irony. And now it's the same place. The whalers came in the 1800s for oil, and now Shell and other oil companies are there for ground oil.
Of course, none of this would have been possible if climate change hadn't affected that environment.
The Arctic is melting twice as fast as the rest of the planet. And the book came about because 3 years ago I started hearing incredible stories coming out of the region that went way beyond oil. I mean, Shell thinks there's 27 billion barrels of oil under the ocean there.
How does that compare to Saudi Arabia?
Well, I can tell you it's three times more than what's been pulled out of the Gulf of Mexico in the last 20 years, and it would make us a big, big player, just that oil. But more than oil, there's also a land rush under the sea for territory between Arctic nations. There are naval war games that have been going on, anticipating terrorists, oil spills. Russian bombers have started buzzing us up there. Whole regions opening up.
Well, oil doesn't know any national boundaries. So if we were drilling oil from U.S. territory, would we also be extracting oil that the Russians could claim, the Norwegians could claim, anyone who has a boundary with the Arctic?
As far as the oil goes, no, in the sense that currently most of the oil is believed to lie within national boundaries. But first, there's this treaty on the table called the Law of the Sea Treaty.
Yeah, but we haven't ratified it.
We're the only country that hasn't ratified it. Were we to ratify it, we would be able to join all the other Arctic countries who are in the process of making claims for up to 200 more miles of undersea territory.
And why haven't we ratified it?
Because it's been blocked in the Senate by Republican senators. It's an amazing treaty, and if you watch the
headlines. What's their argument?
This is coming up again this year, actually, right now. It was in the Times last week. The argument is that they oppose any agreement that would allegedly give other countries, like the United Nations, any kind of say in anything we do. But George Bush backed the treaty. Barack Obama backs it. Sierra Club backs it. Shell Oil backs it. You can't find a treaty that has more disparate elements backing it.
But James Imhoff doesn't back it.
James Imhoff, no. And David Vitter doesn't back it, and it just keeps being blocked over and over again.
Now, how has the melting of the ice affected the lives of the Inupiats?
Amazing. For the book, I travel to remote villages along the Bering Strait, and first I would talk to the elders, whale hunters. These are people who have an oral tradition and who for thousands of years have passed on how you become a hunter. In many villages, the elders are refusing now to teach because the ice has changed so fast. In other villages, people brought out glass jars with insects in them and would say, well, what is this? We haven't seen this before. One time it was a grasshopper, and one other time it was a wasp. And in another island in the Bering Strait, they actually brought out a Sibley's bird guide to North America because so many new species are showing up there, they didn't recognize them. Huge changes.
Are they upset about the possibility that there'll be oil drilling in the area? After all, it would mean jobs for them, wouldn't it?
Toughest question. I think if every American community is wrestling with environment versus development, the choice up there is the most dire. Here's the two sides of the question. Edward Itta, the protagonist in the book, when he grew up, Barrow had 400 people, had no plumbing. He went to a Bureau of Indian Affairs school. He chopped ice with a hatchet for drinking water. His family burned whale blubber for heat, and there was no plumbing. Oil changed that. Oil money is 100% of the North Slope budget. Schools, old folks' homes, roads, rescue squads, all modern amenities from oil. But the flip side is the culture is 4,000 years old, and were there to be an accident offshore, it could destroy not only the whaling, the food supply, the culture. Edward would lie awake at night wrestling with support it or fight it.
Now, that money is coming to them because Alaska has some kind of deal with the oil companies, and that's why it doesn't have to charge any taxes?
The money is coming to the North Slope because the Inupiat Eskimos were smart enough when oil was discovered on land in the North Slope to create the borough as a political entity so that they could tax oil infrastructure on land. So the Alaska pipeline, everything that's pumped out of the land, they get money, and it's about $350 million a year.
My guest is Bob Reese, R-E-I-S-S. His book, The Eskimo and the Oil Man, The Battle at the Top of the World for America's Future, published by Business Plus. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The oil man of your title is Pete Slaby, who works for Shell. What's his job?
Yeah, Pete Slaby runs Shell Oil's Alaska Venture, and you could not find two men who are less alike. You have Edward Itta, the grandfather, on one side. Pete Slaby grew up in Connecticut. He was a lifeguard in high school, swimming pools, liked to drive around in fast cars, Vanderbilt University, went to work for Shell right out of college, and worked all over the world, Brunei, Cameroons, Brazil, Syria. I asked him once, of all those places, dictatorships, third world countries, what's the toughest place you've ever worked? He said, hands down, Alaska. We have more trouble here than anywhere else.
Because his job is to develop partnerships with the local people, and that's been difficult? Or because Alaska is still, despite climate change, very cold and not the most hospitable environment?
None of the problems he referred to are natural problems relating to ice or the environment. All of the problems were man-made problems. You know, Shell paid $2 billion for leases off the North Slope.
For last year?
No, they in two separate auctions back in, I think, 2005, 2007 or 8. I don't have the years exactly right, but they bought several leases, and they've been unable to drill on these leases because, first, Edward Itta stopped them in court because he was afraid. Later, a consortium of environmental groups and some Eskimos stopped them. And still later, when the initial Eskimos dropped out of the suit saying that Shell was sort of okay, federal regulations stopped them after the Deepwater Horizon disaster. One thing after the other as far as Shell is concerned.
Well, now they are going to be drilling, so what's changed?
Well, several things have changed. First, it's not guaranteed that they're going to be drilling because we can expect some last-minute court filings from environmental groups, probably in San Francisco, to try to stop them this summer. But if they do get to drill this summer, what we'll see is a big compromise from the way they started out. Too much, too fast, too soon was the way Edwards said it back in 2007. Shell shrank the number of ships. It will allow federal inspectors on board all the time. It's got a new cap and containment system in case there are oil spills. It's got backup drill rigs. And it agreed to lay off during whale hunting week so the Eskimos could get the whale hunting in.
Throughout the rest of Alaska, are people in support of this sort of thing? Or do they still remember what happened after the Exxon Valdez spill?
Alaska is more addicted to oil money than the rest of America. It is responsible for the prosperity of that state. A very, very small minority of people in Alaska are opposed to this. If you go to a meeting in Anchorage or any of the big cities, overwhelming. I went to one public meeting. I think 40 people spoke before one opposed oil.
Now, drilling in the Gulf, which is rather pleasant, although it does have terrible storms,
yes,
would be quite different than drilling in the Arctic, wouldn't it?
Hugely different. In the Gulf, you can drill 12 months a year. In the Arctic, you can drill. Well, what Shell wants to do this year is called exploratory drilling, so it's different than the Gulf. It's not a fixed platform like that's in your head. They only want to find to see if oil is really there, and they only have permission to go that far.
They don't know if it's truly there? Yeah, we're talking about billions and billions of gallons?
Billions of billions
barrels.
Of barrels.
Yeah.
And no, they don't. They think it's there. Shell was there in the 1990s. They sank wells there. They left. They gave up their leases. Then they re-looked at what they had. They had new seismic information. They had new technology. Oh, no, we think there's a lot of oil there. And then they bought these leases and they came back. Still, like all oil business, it's a guess.
But who owns this? From our conversation, it's my sense that the Eskimos own this land, but who has the final say here? Is it a federal government, Alaska, or the Inupiat?
It's a mess up there. As far as the oil that's under the sea, this is federal land. It was leased by the federal government, and the second biggest source of income for the U.S. Treasury after income tax is oil leasing. So as long as we're on federal land under the ocean, that's the feds. Then you need pipes that come ashore. As soon as the pipes come ashore, we're on Inupiat land and we're on Alaska state land. So then we have those groups as well. Plus, the pipelines could cross polar bear territory. So then you get into environmental laws, and then you have the lawsuits in San Francisco to stop them, which will probably be filed soon.
My guest is Bob Rees, whose latest book is The Eskimo and the Old Man, The Battle at the Top of the World for America's Future. It's published by Business Plus. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And here's a reminder that coming up on Monday, June 4th, the Green Space will present Alan Ayckbourn's radio drama, This Is Where We Came In, about a group of actors trapped in a fractured fairy tale. For tickets, click on events calendar at wnyc.org/thegreenspace. This is WNYC, wnyc.org. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter.
WNYC receives support from Penguin Books, publisher of The Age of Doubt by Andrea Camilleri. The latest Sicilian mystery in the Inspector Montalbano series finds the detective investigating a grisly murder aboard a yacht. Available wherever books are sold. TechServe. On Tuesday, June 5th, TechServe representatives will be attending the Adobe CS6 Production Premium Roadshow at the Midtown Century Center and will be on hand to answer questions about Adobe Creative Suite 6. More at techserve.com/business. WNYC is a media partner of the Brooklyn Film Festival, featuring in competition 100 films at Indie Screen and Brooklyn Heights Cinema from June 1st to June 10th. Details at brooklynfilmfestival.org.
Who should be first in line for an organ transplant? That's a hard call for doctors to make.
I mean, let's face it. I want my patients to get transplanted. I care more about my patients than I care about patients in another city in another part of the country.
That's why I think we can't be trusted.
How doctors are being kept honest in the wait for organ transplants. Today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Beginning at 4 p.m. on WNYC.
Over the course of her career, Regina Spektor has gone from a cult figure in New York's anti-folk scene to a major recording artist. Today, the singer and pianist performed songs from her first new studio album in 3 years, What We Saw from the Cheap Seats. It's coming up at 2 and then 10 on WNYC 93.9 FM. We're back with Bob Reese, who's written about environmental issues over the years. His latest is a book called The Eskimo and the Old Man, The Battle at the Top of the World for America's Future. It's published by Business Plus. When we talk about the debate over drilling in the Arctic, it usually involves discussion of ANWR. Now, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, does that come into play here?
It comes into play in terms of the way the Inupiats We were talking before about this terrible choice that the Inupiats have. Do they support offshore oil or not? Because they need the money and because they fear the destruction of the environment. Most of the Inupiats that I spoke to said that they would prefer if oil would be taken from land. The most promising place for that is ANWR. But ANWR is blocked by federal regulations. I mean, ANWR is beautiful. And so they've accepted that there won't be drilling in the place where there might be oil and land, which leaves them with this choice about under the sea.
Is it the same oil field?
It's the same formation. It's the same formation. It's funny because back in the 60s, geologists flying over the Brooks Range noticed a resemblance to Iranian mountain formations, and that's what got them drilling in the mountain areas. And finally, they struck oil at the very top, not in the mountain areas, but in the tundra. It's the same formations beneath the ocean, yeah.
There are many oil companies vying for opportunities in the Arctic. What's Shell's reputation on the North Slope?
Shell's reputation has changed in the North Slope. First, you're correct. In terms of offshore oil, Shell's got leases. ConocoPhillips, Eni has leases. There's a Spanish company with leases. Statoil, the Norwegian oil company, has leases. Shell was not looked at favorably when they came back into the Arctic in the early 2000s. Their representatives, as far as the Inupiats were concerned, were not taking their concerns into account. And the Shell people who were there at the time were surprised by Inupiat opposition and mistakenly thought that the Inupiats would not be able to stop them. We were surprised, is what the Shell guys said. And boy, were they surprised, because Edward Itta, the 65-year-old whaling captain, stops the second biggest oil company on Earth in court, stops them dead.
So they drilled 32 offshore wells or exploratory wells in 2005, and then a bit. No?
No, no. Those early exploratory wells are back in the 90s, late 80s.
Okay, so when they left, the Inupiat were relieved to see them go. Were they surprised to see them come back?
The Inupiats were not surprised one way or the other. When Shell was there last time, there were a couple of instances where their boats scared away the whales. And here's what this means if you're an Inupiat whale hunter. I mean, twice a year, in the autumn and the spring, the Inupiats go after the whales. Now, in the spring, they camp out at the edge of the ice on top of the Arctic Ocean. They launch these tiny little boats covered with seal skin. They paddle with wooden paddles, and they go after whales, which are about five times bigger than the boat. In spring, they go in these small, small motor boats all the way out in the Arctic Ocean. If whales get diverted, if they go further out to sea and a storm comes up, or if the whalers are trying to bring a whale back to land, that's life and death for them. So whales being diverted by sound is a life or death issue on the slope.
Well, there are a lot of other countries that have that border on the Arctic. Couldn't Shell just go to Canada or to Sweden or to Norway or to Finland or make some deal with the Russians?
Shell is in a lot of other places in the Arctic, and Shell, like many oil companies, believes that the future of oil is in the Arctic. Certainly, the U.S. government believes that something like 20% of the undiscovered hydrocarbons on Earth are in the Arctic. And remember, Shell didn't have any problems last time they were there in the 90s. When they came back in, it was the Bush administration that sold them leases. They were completely taken by surprise when the Inupiats opposed them. And just as a side thing, the way that they get these leases is kind of amazing. It's a huge secret thing among the oil companies. Shell, for instance, found that their office was bugged when they moved into it in Anchorage.
By whom? Did they know?
Well, they didn't know. They found five bugs in the wall when they moved in. And during oil lease time, they rent hotel rooms. They shred the paperwork. They are not supposed to talk to strangers in bars or in the petroleum club. And when they send people up from Houston with the bids, they send two separate guys in separate planes in case there's an accident, separate cars. It's quite an amazing thing, these oil lease auctions. You only get one bid. So if you don't get it the first time, you don't get it.
So you just can't keep on raising your bids. I would think that would be a better way to do it, wouldn't it?
Well, that may or may not be.
I thought that's what auctions were. Do I, you know, we're at $2 billion. Do I hear $2.3 billion?
I know. No, it's more like the Academy Awards, where you have a federal official standing on a stage, and it's in this giant library, and of all these oil guys come in from all over the world. They're sitting there, and someone wheels out a mesh basket with envelopes, and in the envelopes are the sealed bids, and the winner is announced, and people go, oh, no, or high fives, or, you know, big excitement. Only one chance.
There's a lot of research going on in the Arctic, and you went out on a Coast Guard cutter called the Healy. What was it doing?
Well, Healy is amazing. You know, Russia, one of the things I learned in this book is we're last in a lot of places in the Arctic, and one is ice. You know, Russia has 18 icebreakers. The United States has one icebreaker, and it's the Healy. And every summer, it goes up into the Arctic carrying scientists doing research. The cruise I was on, which is about a six-week cruise, the State Department was basically in charge of this because the scientists on board were mapping the sea bottom and taking samples of it in preparation for hopefully one day the United States applying for undersea territory under that treaty we were talking about before. So,
well, do we have no claim now? We still have the normal claims for, what is it, 200 miles from the shore?
Well,
the continental shelf?
Yes. We have what every country has, which is this 200-mile exclusive economic zone where the country owns the mineral rights and the surface of the sea is free for passage to all. But under this treaty, the United States could get an extra area the size of California just off of northern Alaska if you can prove that it also is part of the continental shelf. And no, we cannot make a claim. And the reason is you have to have ratified the treaty to A, be part of the process where they analyze the claims, and B, submit a claim.
Well, I would think at a certain point we were overlapping with other countries' claims. There's only so much space up there.
Two issues there. We are overlapping with Canada. Fortunately, we're buddies with Canada. And in fact, the cruise I was on was a joint U.S.-Canadian icebreaker cruise, partially, you know, to delineate areas there. But the other part is, it's not just what you can claim geopolitically. Remember, when Ronald Reagan was president, he tried to stop Russian gas from crossing Europe because, it is a strategic factor in global affairs. So you want to have a say in who gets what territory. Russia's claimed an area the size of France and Spain combined, and they have claimed the North Pole.
Yeah, they planted a flag on the North Pole.
They dropped the little titanium flag at the bottom of the sea.
Into a piece of ice. Derek from Manhattan, one of our listeners, asks about the Wall Street Journal article in December 2011 that says that a pipeline, road, and bridge would be built in the National Alaska Petroleum Preserve. It would be the second pipeline in Alaska. Do you know about the state of that project?
Right now, a second pipeline in Alaska is not economically viable because the oil companies believe that that particular area does not contain enough oil to justify it. But if Shell, for instance, does find oil where they're looking this year, and if the second stage goes into effect 10 years later, if they get the permissions, if they get to build platforms, if they eventually produce, then a pipeline would cross that area and join up to the existing Alaska pipeline and bring that south.
And they'd have to live within the new regulations that followed the Deepwater Horizon Commission report?
Yeah. One thing that's important here when you're looking at what Shell wants to do is if they come in the ice-free season as they want this year, if they find oil, if they want to proceed, a whole new round of permissions starts, more permits. It's not a lock that they would be able to do it. Absolutely, it would be under these new regulations.
Well, those regulations are similar to the ones that Norway has imposed for years, and Norway seems to be doing rather well.
Rather well is an understatement for Norway. You know, little Norway has 4.5 million people, and they have taken their Arctic hydrocarbon profits and put it in a special fund that they keep for the future if they need it. The Norwegian Pension Fund, which is wholly funded by hydrocarbons from the Arctic, owns 1% of all stocks on Earth. So Norway knows what to do with the money, and Norway has a much better system for leasing and for safety than we do.
So why can't we just follow their model?
Good question, because all the parties that are at each other's throats in Washington over this can only agree on one thing, and it is that Norway does have a better model. The Deepwater Horizon Commission recommended that we institute some of their changes. Norway, for instance, never gives a lease to one company. They'll give it to five companies. And the government will say, okay, you, one company, drill, and the other four companies, you look over that guy's shoulder, and you make sure about safety, and you're investing. So that's a smart thing they do.
Edward Itta has said that he's in support of offshore exploration if it's done right. Did that come as a surprise to Shell?
It didn't come as a surprise to Shell because Edward Itta stopped them and fought them and blocked them and got them to make concession after concession after concession. So finally, when they had made enough of these concessions, Edward uncomfortably, and I was on the phone with him 2 days ago about this after the Times piece came out, just to check where he is. You know, yes, nobody wholeheartedly supports offshore exploration, but he could live with it after that.
Well, during the last presidential campaign, the phrase drill, baby, drill was a Republican refrain. Do you think we'll be hearing it again this election campaign?
I'm sure we'll be hearing it. That, of course, is the other rapacious extreme. And I'm not in favor of drill, baby, drill, you know, wantonly any place. This particular plan is a compromise and took years in the making and is a little different than drill, baby, drill.
But hasn't the Obama administration increased permission for oil drilling?
Despite the
perception that it's been opposed to it?
Yes. Well, the Obama administration has a measured response to drilling. They canceled some leases. They allowed these Shell leases to exist. They stopped all processing of the leases after the Deepwater Horizon Commission while they reexamined the whole system for doing it. And then when they were satisfied, they opened up the permit system again. And now they're requiring some joint science. There are still some things they could do, which they're not doing.
Now, when you began this book, did you have the same take on the story as you have now?
Absolutely not. This book was a complete surprise. And I even feel guilty sometimes I'm an environmental writer. My other books, Rainforest Destruction, Global Warming, I went into it objectively, but I went into it suspecting that, as in the past, I would not be in support of an oil drilling plan at the end. And yet, when Edward changed his mind, when the head of the Coast Guard in Alaska said he was satisfied with Shell precautions, when William Riley, co-chair of the Deepwater Horizon Commission, told me he thought Shell was being jerked around, and he used those words, and he advised Obama to let him drill. And when the Inupiat whaling captains dropped their opposition to this, I changed my mind.
Now, the Arctic is easier to do things in because of climate change. Does that mean that other people other than oil companies are looking at it as a source of, for example, mining?
Oh, big time. You know, the newest diamond mines in the world are in the Arctic and Canada, and the Chinese are quite interested in mining in the Arctic. The Russians have started escorting tankers around the top of their Arctic, and tourist ships have actually started going through the Northwest Passage in our part of the Arctic regularly. So sea passages, it's like a whole new ocean on Earth that has suddenly opened up. And the Navy commissioned a study on this, and they're thinking that by 2080, at the latest, the whole Arctic will be ice-free in summers.
I don't know what the Inupiat think about that, but what are their thoughts about more mining in the area?
They fear mining. They fear all of this stuff. One reason why...
Because it'll just change the way they live their lives, or...?
Because the government is not... United States is... One Coast Guard admiral put it this way to me. If the Arctic was a ball game, the United States wouldn't be on the field, we wouldn't be in the stands, we wouldn't be in the parking lot, and we wouldn't even be in the vicinity because we're so far behind all the other countries. And one reason why the law of the sea would be a good thing to pass is that it creates some rules for the Arctic. The fear is that the Arctic will melt so fast and these trade routes will open up so fast and the mining and ship disasters will happen so fast, there won't be regulations, the Navy won't be ready for it, the Coast Guard won't have ships. That's what they fear.
What about the fact that there won't be any ice there in the summertime? That will change the way it changes the Earth, doesn't it?
It totally changes the Earth. And all of this stuff, I mean, every single aspect of this affects every American in every single city. I mean, whether or not it's climate or the price of televisions because Chinese tankers can save $2 million each way going over the top of the planet, or whether it affects security because our Navy is going to be up there. We're all affected by what goes on there, and it will only happen more, and the headlines will show it this summer.
So you see, this is having much more global significance than whether we do a little bit of drilling up there.
Rudyard Kipling's phrase, the great game, applied to the way great powers duke it out in remote places. Now it's our backyard, the Arctic.
Bob Reese's book, The Eskimo and the Oil Man, The Battle at the Top of the World for America's Future, is published by Business Plus. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you very much.